Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Welcome, everybody, to our next week in Hunting Magic Eels. Bev and Bruce, did you take your Hunting Magic Eels with you?
That was too much weight in my...
Well, we are going to talk this evening about eccentricity. Eccentricity. So I know some of you are more expert on being eccentric than the rest of us are. So just, you know, be patient with us, those of us who are still learning to be eccentric. And we're going to talk about charismatic enchantments this evening as well. So one of the core practices of charismatic enchantment is the practice of testimony. Testimony, and that's when we talk about the way that God has intervened in our lives. So here is the tiniest, most innocuous little piece of testimony for you. William, as you know, prepares and offers a gift of music every Sunday in worship. And he had a gift of music all picked out for yesterday. And then he couldn't use it for logistical reasons. We couldn't use it yesterday, so he's moving it to next week instead. But it turns out that the piece actually works better with next Sunday's scripture reading. And I think the one for yesterday worked really well with yesterday's scripture reading. And I am certain that the Holy Spirit helps us plan worship. There's my testimony.
Is that called divine intervention?
That is called divine intervention. We are going to talk about divine intervention tonight. Are you excited? Answer, yes. Good.
Yes.
It happens. Yeah. And charismatic enchantments are going to be all about paying attention to the way that God intervenes in our everyday life and in much bigger ways than, God helped us choose a better piece of music for a given worship service. Although that one counts, right? It's categorically the right kind of enchantment. So we're gonna talk about that. But first, I need to talk about eccentricity. We actually talked a little bit about it last week when I was talking about Viktor Frankl and that sense that as sort of our ability to persist in the world depends on the sense that we make a difference, that we matter beyond ourselves, that we have a purpose for getting through these days. And so Frankl's experience was much more extreme than any of ours that I'm aware of. But he's talking about the idea that we need a sense that we have a purpose that matters beyond ourselves. And so that beyond ourselves aspect is what we mean when we talk about eccentricity. So here's an eccentric religious experience that happened to Johnny Cash. This actually saved his life. So Richard Beck has a whole book about the gospel according to Johnny Cash. It's called Guns, Trains, and Murder. And so in 1967, Johnny Cash was suffering from substance abuse and depression, and he attempted suicide. He wandered intentionally deep into Nickajack Cave until his flashlight batteries died. His goal was to get so lost that he would never be able to come back out again. There's a metaphor right there if you want one. But he gets there in the cave, flashlight batteries run out, no idea where he is, lies down, waits to die. And suddenly this voice comes to him, and the voice says, "I am still here. I am still here." God had never abandoned Johnny Cash. And so he had this moment of realization, because God spoke to him in an audible to him voice. And so he crawled back out of the cave and began again. Now, I should pause for a little sidebar here. I emphatically believe that God never abandons us, and that includes those who complete their suicide attempts. God never abandons us. I need to say that. But Johnny Cash had there in the cave, as that voice spoke to him, he was having what William James, a sort of turn of the 20th century psychologist, would call a religious experience. William James's great book is The Varieties of Religious Experience. And so he said a religious experience categorically is a sense of reality, a feeling of objective presence, a perception of what we might call something more deep and more general than what our senses reveal to us. And so that may be like a really tangible supernatural event, like that voice that spoke to Johnny Cash, or it may be some insight that we don't quite sense, but we intuit. We know it's there, that comes to us from somewhere. And William James, cataloging these religious experiences, says, okay, they've got these four characteristics. One, they are ineffable. They're not something that we can adequately put into words. And so when we talk about religious experience or try to convey religious experience, we turn so often to, you know, art and music and poetry, because these experiences are not about explanation, and talking about them is not about explanation. They're really about attention. So we have to turn to these other modes of expression other than explaining. Religious experiences, William James still, are transitory. We have to work hard to remember them. Blaise Pascal, the 17th century mathematician and philosopher, had a supernatural religious experience, and he wrote it down on paper and sewed it into his overcoat. So he would always have it with him, but he had to write it down so that he could carry it with him, because they pass, and they even pass away from our remembered experience. Religious experiences are passive. They happen to us. We don't make them happen. They happen to us. This is what Beck is going to mean when he talks about eccentric. They come to us from outside, in the way that a gift comes to us from the outside. You know, if you got to that point in life where you had to buy your own Christmas gifts, right? And they're way more disappointing than if somebody actually buys you a Christmas gift, even if the gift somebody else gives you is lousy, right? Because it is in the character of a gift that it comes to you from outside. It is in the character of religious experience that it comes to you from outside. And William James also says that religious experience is noetic. That was Greek. Noetic. They are revelatory. They show us or give us an insight about something that we couldn't otherwise perceive. The actual New Testament word for this is apocalyptic. Apocalypse is a revealing or an unveiling. It shows us something that was there, but it was hidden, right? That's what veils do, right? They cover up what is actually there. And so if this is an important piece of when we're talking about religious experiences, that we're talking about unveiling, but what's unveiled has been present all along, right? And so we're not talking about something necessarily that's completely spectacular, but instead we're actually having these religious experiences, these revelatory experiences, these apocalyptic experiences. I'm just trying to desensitize you to the word. We're actually having these apocalyptic experiences all the time if we are attentive to what's being unveiled. So what is it that's being unveiled. What does this revelatory experience reveal? It reveals things like identity and calling and conviction. So it can reveal to us an identity. It fills us with a sense of God's love for us and for others. It gives us a calling. These religious experiences can nudge us to encounter God's presence somewhere in particular with someone in particular. And it can awaken moral convictions in us. This encounter with God actually expands our love for God's world. And this is all part of these experiences that come to us from the outside, and this encounter with a God who is not just like within me, right? But is out there beyond me, this transcendent God, that those experiences pull me out of myself and out of being centered only in myself. So these experiences happen outside us, but they happen in this reality. We're not talking about something that is imagined. We're talking about a God who is transcendent beyond us, but who is also present with us in this world, right? So we talk about the incarnation of God coming into human form. We talk about the Holy Spirit, which is the person of God who is present with us even right now, if we can see it. So this is, again, within this reality, outside ourselves. It's outside ourselves, but it's in this reality. It's important that it is in this reality. Again, enchantment is not about pretending. It's not about, you know, fleeing from the world. It's actually about rediscovering the world. So when Jesus talks about become like a child, right? He's one of the things that he seems to be referring to is that ability to be surprised, that ability to wonder at the world around us, to see things as if they were new. And enchantment is about seeing God present beyond our present circumstances. So what we can see and experience and what God's presence can mean for us, that's not bounded by our circumstances. One of the experiences, contexts that Beck will talk about in the charismatic enchantment chapter is the context of a Bible study that he leads at a maximum security prison outside of Abilene. And so when he talks about these modes of enchantment and he talks about being circumscribed by your circumstances, he means it. You know, he knows the context in which, if he's going to talk meaningfully about these enchantments, he needs to talk about these enchantments in a way that makes sense in prison and on the wrong side of town. That's the other context that he works a lot from. So these experiences come to us from outside. They come to us from outside ourselves. And so I'm going to give you a minute to kind of chew and swallow just that little piece. And then we'll turn to these charismatic enchantments that I think really kind of, they especially point to the way that these experiences come from outside us. So I'm just going to give you one quick minute of silence here. Just kind of notice what you heard that interested you. We might want to come back to. Notice in yourself any questions that may have come up for you. You can write those down on your little hotel stationery if you like. And then we'll move on. So we're going to talk about charismatic enchantments this evening. And I will acknowledge for myself that charismatic enchantments are the farthest from my comfort zone, which probably makes the most worthwhile for me anyway. So if they are also far from your comfort zone, then I hope this will be a really productive time. So charismatic practices, charismatic attention has this quality of decentering us, pulling us outside of ourselves. So Beck discovered charismatic enchantment after he had worked really hard as a good progressive skeptical academic to really wear down his faith. He never quit being Christian, but he really wanted to wrestle with the big questions and wrestle with the, you know, how do I know the things that I believe and what's the really good theology here, right? And so that skepticism and that analysis came really easily to him as an academic. And he realized that he had completely sort of emptied his faith of life. And so he left home, he left his spiritual home, and he began worshiping with a mission church that his home congregation was planting. And so he went to worship with Freedom Fellowship among the poor in Abilene, and found when he went there to be part of this church plant that he was suddenly worshiping in a style that was much more charismatic and emotionally expressive than his home congregation. The charismatic enchantment of this congregation really has transformed Beck's own Christian faith and relationship with God. So these charismatic and Pentecostal traditions, he's using both of these in the lowercase. These charismatic and Pentecostal traditions, he says, may be the most enchanted streams of Christianity today. And he's identifying these traditions across denominational lines. And so you can find, well, he's worshiping among charismatics in the Churches of Christ. You can find charismatic Presbyterians. You can find charismatic Catholics. You can find charismatic Lutherans. You can even find charismatics in the Assembly of God. But you can especially find these charismatic and Pentecostal traditions flourishing among the poor and the oppressed. And this mode of enchantment really thrives on the margins of society. And that probably means that it makes a lot of us more uncomfortable, say, than the liturgical enchantment or the contemplative enchantment, that we can kind of, okay, that seems, you know, somebody could be doing that in the midst of our regular worship at Covenant and we wouldn't even notice, right? For me, in my position at the very center of Western Euro-American Christian society, these charismatic enchantments on the margins make me the most uncomfortable. And sometimes we'll admit that that could be make us uncomfortable for a good reason, because skepticism is good too. Right? Beck is able to identify, yeah, there are some excesses in this charismatic stream of Christian practice, but it's actually easier, in his opinion, to sort of rein in the excesses of the charismatic traditions than it is to re-enliven a disenchanted faith that we have just completely worn down. So from the outside, what does charismatic enchantment look like? From the outside, it looks like this expressive, emotional, demonstrative worship. But don't let that throw you off the scent. That's just a piece of what it looks like on the outside. It looks like testimonies. It looks like people being able to tell their stories of grace, of times that God showed up. So in and out of the very real pain of living on the margins of society, and society, you know, this Western Euro-American Christian society has made it really painful to be on the margins. And in through that pain is this ribbon of grace when God shows up in these unlikely moments, unlikely people, unlikely ways. And so in these testimonies, we're going to talk about miracles. We're going to talk about healing. We're going to talk about money showing up right when you need it. We're going to talk about these chance encounters that were God intervening in your life. These are these daily routine moments when it is clear that God is alive and at work in your life.
Real example.
James Smith, who is a scholar of these charismatic traditions, he says that the charismatic approach is a hermeneutics of gratitude. How do we interpret the world around us? That's what hermeneutics means. How do we make sense of the world around us? And he says, we interpret the world around us and we interpret the Bible through gratitude, this position of radical openness to God. And in particular, openness to God doing something different or new. So that's what this hermeneutics of gratitude is about. We are open to God doing something different or new. And that, of course, raises all of my like skeptical alarm bells, right? So my skeptical posture would want to debate, well, you know, how did that happen? Why did that happen? Does God really save you a parking space? Like, you know, surely somebody just, you know, dropped that $20 bill, right? But the fact remains, it happened. So my skeptical questions are actually far beside the point, because what matters is that this happened. These miracle stories, these testimonies are a practice of attention and attending to God, intervening with grace to rescue us from situations that were lousy. There is also a thread in these charismatic enchantments, a thread of talking about spiritual warfare. That with, you know, in the context of this pain and the difficulty of life that God needs to intervene and rescue us from, we are in the midst of this fight between demonic and angelic forces. And the powers in this are, our power in this is prayer and scripture and the name of Jesus. So for instance, this is where the prison Bible study matters. Beck was teaching his Bible study folks at the maximum security prison. He was teaching them the Beatitudes, you know, and the Beatitudes are great and wonderful, right? Until he gets to blessed are the meek. And one guy in the Bible study says, you can't do that in here. You can't do that in here. You can't do meek in the maximum security prison. Because the maximum security prison, life in the maximum security prison is controlled by a demonic power. And Beck said that's the best way to make sense of the dog-eat-dog environment that is really cultivated within a maximum security prison. We could talk about why that happens. That's a skeptical question. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is there's a demonic power at work where saying blessed are the meek, which sounds lovely to us, right? That's completely incompatible with the life that these guys had to live in the prison. So Beck is a big fan of believing in Satan. He thinks that Satan is a really important way of understanding faith. He said, if we don't believe in Satan, then Christianity becomes this moralized, politicized thing. This is what we talked about last week in the slow death of God, right? That we had shifted from this enchanted world to this moralized world where it's not a matter of experiencing God, it's a matter of doing the right stuff, right? And so he says, it's actually this understanding of spiritual warfare, and the word spiritual is essential there, But this understanding of spiritual warfare is actually how we can get at a deeper truth about how hard it is to navigate the moral and political fields of life. So that very present reality that you know, God is in conflict with forces in the world that are opposed to God. That's part of what makes this charismatic context make sense. The charismatic enchantment uses our emotions above all in encountering God. So this is Blaise Pascal again, mathematician, philosopher, mystic, right? He is all three of those things. And he's the one who said, the heart has its reasons which reason does not know. The heart has its reasons which reason does not know. And he's not talking about romance, he's actually talking about theology. The heart has its reasons which reason does not know. It is the heart which experiences God and not the reason. Which is not to say that science is no good, right? But it is to understand that we don't love because science has deduced for us that we should love, right? We don't love our spouse or our parents or our kids or our pets because we have worked out that, yes, this creature is worthy of my love, right? No, we love because we love, and any reasoning we do about that is secondary to the fact that we love. So enchantment involves reconnecting your head with your heart. So let me recommend to you the enchantments of charismatic worship, no matter where you go to church, which of course you all go to church right where you are presently sitting right now. Wherever you go to church, let me recommend charismatic worship. When it's time to sing, sing, and sing loudly, and open your heart and surrender to the praise and move and raise your hands or kneel during prayer. Let your body confess and your emotions embrace the truth that your mind cannot. Because faith is not an accounting problem, it's a romance. That's where charismatic faith is going to point us. So again, chew and swallow. Take a minute. Quietly just notice what you heard that interested you. Notice what questions have come up for you. And we will share those after a minute. So I'm going to take as a point of personal privilege that I'm going to say the first piece talking about a hermeneutics of gratitude. I am really grateful not only to you but for you for this chance to kind of work through this material before I turn around and teach it again at Synod School. So you get to be my guinea pigs, but I have found as we've gone through this, some ways that I want to sort of rearrange and restructure some of how I'm presenting this stuff. And I would not have been able to do that without y'all. Yeah. So thank you for that. Now, the skeptical side of me, right? My left brain is all like, well, of course there would have been ways to do that without them, right? There are ways to do this. This is the thing I said really true? Yes, it's true, right? It may not be factual, but it's true that I could not have done this without you. So thank you for that. There's a brief practice of the hermeneutics of gratitude.
Yeah.
One thing that comes to mind, excuse me, is that I was listening to the radio last night, and there was an interview of Michio Kaku, is his name, famous physicist. You've probably seen him, whether you know it or not, because he gets interviewed a lot. He's a very interesting interview. And he was talking about the universe and what it really is, and the fact that we think we are in the only one, and science is increasingly deciding that we are in one of many. Now, that goes beyond my ability to concentrate on, particularly at bedtime. But that is another kind of, I don't know whether he's to say we should be more enchanted by the idea that there are things we don't know, that what we think is science is just a pinch of the truth, or whether we're supposed to think that everything is explainable by science or rationality, at least. And that gets us away from eels. So I wasn't sure which way to take that, but I was thinking about it last night. And if any of you have the answer, I'll get you Michio Kaku's phone number, and you need to get a hold of it.
John, if you have Michio Kaku's phone number, just give it to me anyway. I don't have any answers for him, but that'd be fun. So yeah, there is some really amazing just sort of natural philosophy. That's actually what physics used to be called back when Newton did it. Natural philosophy about, what does it mean for life that we are in one of how many bazillion universes, and how do we live that? And the wonder of that, that's where it becomes enchanted again, right? The wonder of that. And among academics, actually, physicists are more likely than your average academic to be religious people in interesting ways. So I don't know if that's the same, it's not the same flavor of enchantment we're talking about, but it's eccentric, isn't it? That sense that there is so much more reality beyond us that we can never possibly contain it, right? That's actually what eccentricity is about.
You can't explain eccentric eels. I mean, magic eels. And by the way, Nathan, offline sometime, I have an interesting book that is written by two physicists about angels that I think you might find interesting. I'm not even sure I finished it, but I was finding it interesting before I put it away someplace.
All right. Bev.
Maeve.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sue.
I just wanted to know what chapter was for. I got my book this afternoon, so I've been reading.
Oh, okay. Oh, great. For tonight, we read chapter 3, Eccentric Experiences, and chapter 8, Charismatic Enchantment. So when we talk about eccentric experiences, what we're talking about is the idea that that our experiences of God come to us from outside. So we're not looking just inside ourselves for this, but they're actually this intervention from beyond us. And so part of enchantment is about centering our attention and centering our sense of self, not within ourselves, but beyond ourselves. So we're always looking out there for more. And then these charismatic enchantments, you were here for most of the little lecture on that. So this more emotive, expressive way of worship, but that also is talking about how God intervenes in our lives. So how did God come save us?
I'll keep reading.
Bev, and then we'll go to Marcy. Marcy, I see you waving. We'll get to you, but Bev was going to say something, and then we'll come down to you.
Just a quick note, going back to John and Cash, going into the cave, and hearing a voice that came to him. Being the Chicago person that I am, and the skeptic that I am in believing in that, I mean, truly, do you honestly, well, that doesn't matter. My question would be, it could also have just been in his head and he did a 180. Is that true? And what does Beck have to say about that? And the second part, now this is the part that really, I'm a marketing person, but I also am very good with numbers. So I don't know, right or left side of brain, what is the reality? But in when you were talking about things that happened to us, there is a book called The Secret by Rhonda Byrne. And it is amazing. This has been going on since the creation of man. They have it in writing back in the old philosophers. Things happen to us, whether it's in our heads, whether it's an actual physical kind of a thing. But like finding the first parking spot, one of her best examples, it's because you believe, let's go peek. You don't stop at parking spot number 7 back here. You just say, you know, it's a good day today. I'm just going to drive by. And you know what? I tested it. It works. And there are things that you think you're creating, but it's just a matter of, like you say exactly, listening, feeling, being open.
Yeah. So those are both layers of this. Both of those points are sort of that skeptical approach to what is a fundamentally anti-skeptical mode of enchantment. And we will get to in 2 weeks, we're going to talk about discernment, discerning the spirits. So this is that's biblical language. But discerning, you know, kind of, was that God or was that just the pizza? That's Phyllis Tickle's line. Was that God speaking to Johnny Cash, or was there some part of his brain that was like, hang on a second, right? Or was that parking spot there the whole time and I just wasn't looking? So there are pieces of that that are a discernment question. So are we talking responsibly about God when we talk about God saved me a parking spot? Well, why did God save you a parking spot, right? That actually kind of, not why do you think God saved you a parking spot, but why would God have done that? What are you gonna do with that parking spot? I believed it could be there and so it showed up. There's a really strong resonance between the charismatic mode of enchantment and the prosperity gospel. This idea that if I just want it bad enough, God will give me, you know, a new car or whatever. And so there are pieces of this that's where it's going to become a discernment question. But who's to say God didn't organize things such that I could get that parking spot, right? Or who's to say that part of Johnny Cash's brain that I skeptically am like, oh yeah, no, like, you know, there's something in his brain that would be like, hang on a second, you should probably not die in this cave. Who am I to say that God can't work through that? So there's a piece that is it's not that God has to be supernaturally out there, right? God can be at work through the stuff of this world.
So Johnny, in trying to cash out, actually cashed in.
Oh, cute.
Is that good? Oh, John doesn't like it.
But true. Think about, did he cash in first or cash out first? Well, he obviously...
he cashed in when he was trying to cash out.
Yeah.
He picked up another good 35, 40 years, though.
Yeah.
Once he came back out of that cave. So I'm going to let Marcy in.
Right.
Marcy, you are muted. Marcy, you are muted.
How's that?
Better.
Okay. We're talking about the universe and everything. I always liked that passage in Psalms, and I couldn't swear that it's 104 or not, but talking about we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And who is man that God notices us, or even, you know, that even relates to us, which to me says the universe is so big, bigger than what I think the universe is. And who is God that God is mindful of me? You know, as a little speck in the universe, God is even mindful of me, regardless how big the universe is.
Right. And these charismatic enchantments are exactly about that God is mindful of me. That was 139 and 8 kind of mashed up together. That was great. But well, you know, in the great scheme of the universe, God cares about me. That's actually kind of what those charismatic enchantments really pay attention to, right? Because in the great scheme of the universe, I've still got to figure out how to get through the day, and it turns out God is there walking me through my day.
The other point I was going to make is that. When we're talking about being Pentecostal, or however you want to describe that, you know, there's a reason that we call Presbyterians the frozen chosen. You know, we understand our theology not to be about necessarily being effusive or spontaneous or, you know, feeling in the spirit. When in fact there are people who might very well feel that, but feel constricted by Presbyterian presence. So it's kind of nice to go someplace where people dance and people, I don't know that I want to roll around on the floor, but, you know, do all the spontaneous stuff. But it's kind of scary too. If you go to it and you're not used to it, it's talk about making you uncomfortable.
Yeah. So the I'm going to add a word here. White Presbyterian tradition is a very sort of constrained, stolid kind of worship style, which doesn't mean we can't sing wonderfully, right?
Oh, yeah.
But when we talk about the kinds of emotive worship that we often associate with a word like charismatic or Pentecostal. A lot of white Presbyterians get real woohoo. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Presbyterians of color.
I was talking to Melba Costin, who wrote the last Presbyterian hymnal, she was on the committee for the last one. And we're, you know, how sometimes you just stand around and sing hymns, and she was playing the piano. And she could not believe that this little white girl knew all the spirituals. And I said, well, you know, my part of my family is not just First and United Presbyterian, but, I'm going to lose the name. What's the third denomination that's more rural?
Are you thinking Cumberland?
Cumberland. And my grandmother's Cumberland church could rock, you know. they knew how to clap and move and
again, there you're going to have a situation, sort of a social situation that is more like, say, the Black Presbyterian Church.
Yes.
Where again, you're more on the margins of society. In the Cumberland denomination, that's in Appalachia and the just grind of economic life in Appalachia, right? And again, notice what Beck said about these charismatic enchantments, that these really take root in the lives of people on the margins. And so there's a very clear link there, not only with the Black worship traditions, which are, you know, in the context of the social and economic racism that we've been talking about all year, but you get similarly in poor white traditions.
Yeah, and they were definitely poor white
communities. Yeah, so
but they didn't get crazy and throw snakes around. They did draw the line on that.
Let's not caricature folks, though. Let's not caricature styles of worship.
You start throwing the snakes around, and I am out of the door. So,
but let's not caricature styles of worship because, because we are deliberately talking about a style of worship that already makes me uncomfortable, right? And so I'm going to just project that onto a lot of the rest of us. And I know this from dealing with other white Presbyterians. This makes a lot of white Presbyterians uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that's part of what the value is of digging into this. Spending time with these traditions and recognizing that, oh my goodness, these are folks who have a real living relationship with God who intervenes in their daily lives, and they just are actually paying attention to it. So it's okay that their worship makes us uncomfortable because we're not the ones they're worshiping.
That's Russ. Right.
I wanted to comment on the analysis of Johnny Cash, hearing that still small voice. I mean, whether it was actually God speaking to him or just something in his head. I think the important thing is he was convinced he was God speaking to him.
Yeah.
And that's the important part. It changed his life.
And your right brain is really good at sort of holding the both and of that, right? That your right brain can be like, oh yeah, you know, that was, you know, something happened in his head and he thought that, and that was God speaking to him, right? Mm-hmm. These things don't have to be mutually exclusive.
Right, yeah.
And we can, you know, we can write a poem or a song about it, and, you know, your left brain can get all worried because, you know, the grammar isn't right, right? Because grammar isn't right in poems. You're not writing in complete sentences in most poems. Some poems are, and that's wonderful too, but that's not the point either. Okay. Your right brain can handle, oh my goodness, something fired in Johnny Cash's brain. Some two neurons came together and sent a little electric spark between them, and something happened, and praise God, he came out of the cave, right? Both of those things, hallelujah. Yeah, so it can be both. Because as Russ says, he noticed it that way. He paid attention to God speaking to him in this cave.
And it is possible to overanalyze it.
Sure is, isn't it?
As far as style of worship, Warren, when you had that C store, you used to, you said Tecumseh Holmes used to stop in sometimes. I wondered, did you ever visit his church?
No, and he visited ours, and I'm sure he invited us at any time to come, and no, I should have. And I think he was one of several, many years that I've been at Covenant, guest pastors that coming in that could sense how white Presbyterian the congregation was in terms of our failure to respond or such a modest response that had he been in his home church would have been an entirely different response
from
the congregation. But no, and just for a footnote, and Russ, you probably know this, convenience stores sell cigarettes and beer, and I happen to have some adult magazines. Good profit. And he was petitioning me to take out the adult magazines. And they were in my store just immediately to my left. There wasn't way at the back of the store. I mean, I knew who was there, and I had a sign, buy, B-U-Y, or buy, B-Y. It wasn't a reading room. And he and I talked about that a couple of times. I said, you know what? Alcohol does an awful lot of evil things to people. You know, the next group may want me to take out beer. And, you know, we have a lot of obese people. And think of all the candy and sugared pop. I says, frankly, I'm either going to be a convenience store, being legal, or I ought to look to something else. Because if I can't make this selling gasoline at cost. In those days, I was getting my rear kicked on gas being the loss leader. And M&Ms. I got to have something in the store with some profit. But anyway, I'm pleased you remembered Tecumseh because, and eventually I closed the store. So he may have had the ultimate victory.
What might be happenstance? There might be the intervention of God in somebody saved a parking spot. I have what I class as a similar experience, although in earthly terms it was very different, but I can't make any more sense of it. I was in a car accident about 15 years ago. If I'd been 10 feet not as far down the road, I would have missed it. If I'd been 10 feet further, I would have been crushed under a semi. Now, I can say God had a purpose for me or God intervened, but to this day, I don't even know how to think about that. I don't think about it because I can't come up with an answer. Some of these things are a matter of what we're prepared to accept. I apparently am not prepared to accept either of those alternatives, and I don't know why. Maybe that's God preparing me not to accept things. But I'll go back a couple of weeks, and I said it's a matter of paying attention. And if I'm paying attention to God in one way at one time, I'll interpret something one way. If I'm paying attention to God some other way, it'll be the opposite result. And I'm just thinking today in a totally different context about meeting Tammy. We had to meet three separate times, three separate places, years apart, before we went, oh, she's kind of nice. I don't know. Was God in that one way or the other? I don't know. And I'm not answering any questions that you have raised, Rev, but I'm telling you, I'm still lost. And by the way, Reverend Marcy, I caught you almost saying life, the universe, and everything a few minutes ago.
Sorry, what?
You said, you almost said life, the universe, and everything. And I'm getting
life,
one smile.
Life, the universe, and everything?
Life, the universe, and everything. Okay, I thought you'd be the one that would smile. Never mind. I'll have to explain it offline. But Rev got that.
So, Yeah, I did get that. Those moments of, we call them happenstance, because we're, you know, the old line, you know, coincidences are when God chooses to remain anonymous. We've got this, there is something in us that seems to kind of resist claiming these miracles, right? Claiming these moments of divine intervention. Yeah. And this charismatic mode of enchantment invites us to see those and recognize those and celebrate those. Mm-hmm. And part of what is, you know, part of what is challenging and as a matter of kind of spiritual honesty and humility, part of what's challenging about that mode of enchantment is the idea that God spared John's life that day by making sure that he wasn't 10 feet farther down the road than he was, but, you know, however many other people that same day were killed in car accidents, did God choose not to spare their lives, right? And this charismatic enchantment does not satisfactorily answer those questions, right? At least in a clean, neat, tidy, logical, philosophical kind of way. It just doesn't answer those questions, because that's not the question that it's trying to answer, right? So no one of these modes of enchantment, no one theology does all the work. But that doesn't mean, you know, the fact that you know, however many people across the United States died in car accidents that same day that John didn't, that fact does not have to take away from our ability to be grateful that John lived through that one. And most of us, most of the time, are grateful that John lived through that one.
Yeah. Thank you for the music he wrote.
So, I don't want to overstate the case. So we can be grateful even though all of our questions are not answered, right? So that's a piece of the gift that charismatic enchantment invites us into, is that again, hermeneutics of gratitude. We can be grateful that we met our spouse however many times it took us to meet them before we figured it out, right? We can be grateful that we are not with our spouse anymore, no matter how many times it took us to figure out that that's the way it needed to be, right? We can be grateful that, you know, we had the food that we had provided for us by the strange, complicated network of people that it took to provide the food for us this evening, even though we know there are people starving around the world. And our lack of gratitude for the food that we receive from God's bounteous hand does not, you know, our lack of gratitude for that wouldn't feed anybody. Our gratitude for that actually has a tendency to feed other people. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a couple weeks too, because that's part of the discernment piece. Part of, are we discerning God or are we discerning something else? So this wow kind of gratitude, this thank you God kind of gratitude, even if this part of our brain, this is my left side, even if this part of our brain is like, oh, you know, there's plenty of reasons for this, this part of our brain is able to say, wow, thank God for that. There's charismatic enchantment for you.
Hey, I hate to break off, but I'm about to run out of power on my phone. Do you have a quick closing statement, or was that it?
That was the closing for my contribution to the evening. We might stick around and talk. You never know. For next week, we chapters 9 and 10.
Okay.
Chapters 9 and 10.
I would hate to cut somebody off because the phone died. So Y'all have a good night, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
See you next week, Marcy. Oh, we can't quite make you out this time. Something is funny with your audio.
Can you hear me now?
A little better, not much.
Now, okay, remember this. Audio just wasn't there. So whatever you said about funny, I'll refer to Bruce. He can answer that.
Bruce, I think you just got put on the spot to say something funny.
Something funny.
Oh, like a professional.
Oh boy, it doesn't stop. Thanks, John. Wow. This is, if I may speak.
You may speak, and then we'll go to Warren.
Oh, Warren, I'm sorry. I didn't see your hand.
No, that's all right. It was one of those, you were both volunteering at the same time. So we'll go Bev, and then we'll go Warren.
Well, he may be more profound than I, so let him go first.
I doubt that.
Ooh, yeah. Warren, say something profound.
I have never been called lucky. I've never been called handy, and I don't think I've ever been called profound. I just wanted to mention, I think it's the last page of chapter 3. It says, if we bring a little willingness to see, we've been bumping into God our entire lives. We've just been too distracted to notice, too busy to stop and pay attention, too hurried to say, here I am, here am I, send me. And the more I think about that, it kind of makes me think of that phrase or that poem, Footsteps in the Sand, that the individual thinks that he's been abandoned, that there weren't four footsteps in the sand, there were only two, and of course he was being carried. And that's what this really hit me, is, you know, going through life, our jobs, all these things, you know, we have probably been bumping into God and weren't aware of it. We were just too distracted, too busy. And, yeah. You know, does it take a hammer wrapping you in the head to be observant and know? And earlier in the session, I think we were talking about how we don't realize how many times we have had influence on others. We're not aware of it. And I'm sure the same thing applies. We don't realize on some of the events, good and bad, that happened to us, how much of that should be attributed to God taking care of us, assisting us, supporting us. And once again, just went right over my head. I wasn't perceptive enough. You know, it's kind of like when the things are going well, I'm a genius. When things are going bad, I'm thinking, God, does he think I'm Job? And there's been a few stretches, talking about the convenience store, there's been a few stretches in my life where I thought I was Job's first cousin. That was a terrible, terrible year of 1992. Is in the picture household, a very difficult year, very difficult. Lost a mother-in-law, closed the store, sent firstborn off to college. I mean, there's more that I can share, but I mean, I'm thinking, whoa, when is this going to end? But then when things are going well, so you kind of think, man, I'm the smartest guy on the block.
Yeah. And so So this is that question of paying attention, yeah, as you say, Warren, paying attention that God has been there the whole time.
Yeah.
And these testimonies of God rescuing us are, you know, that footprints story is, you know, at the end of this guy's life, right? And he's looking back over his entire life with the footprints. But but these testimonies are about a lot more recent than that. That here's when God showed up in this particular way, and here's when I asked for God in that particular way. And that is a way of being attentive to God who is already there. I love that you brought us back to that. We've been bumping into God our entire lives.
Yeah.
All right, Bev, do you have something that profound?
But you know what, Warren? I think it came to me when you're saying bumping into him throughout your life. I truly think those are the days, the moments that we tune in. And to, like Rev says, just, you know, turn that notch, turn that little antenna just one more scooch of a notch, and you will hear more without, if you can give yourself some time throughout the day. It's amazing. And when we think positively, that brings another entire focus on seeing all that is. And sometimes it's, like you say, sometimes it's better than others. So I'm just amazed, and thank you. My original thought was, thank you, Nathan. Again, this is really amazing to me. The things that come back to me and things to be thankful for and things to say, ooh, you know, was that just in my head? But even if it was just in my head for Johnny Cash, it could have been there because of God's touch.
Right. And that's where we're bringing God back to life, right? Remember, we killed God slowly last week with this mechanistic understanding of things either exist in the known universe according to those laws, or they're about God. And what if it's and? Yeah. Mary.
Well, I have an experience. Goes back to July 5th, 1994. Russ and I and my mother and our son Bill and his wife Rhonda and our son Greg were walking through Rest Haven Cemetery looking for a spot to bury our 22-year-old son who'd been killed in an automobile accident 2 days before. I mean, here's this vast cemetery, we have no idea, and we come around here, and all of a sudden, I don't know, because I hadn't thought about anything, all of a sudden, I look, and I said, you bury an Eagle Scout under the flagpole. This was spot close to the flagpole. She says, well, we have three spots right over there, and everybody agreed, and it wasn't like I'm thinking, oh, well, we've got to go find a place. It just came to me just like that, like a bolt of lightning, and I just figure that's got to be a God experience, because it didn't come from me.
Hallelujah.
Unfortunately, they moved the flagpole.
What?
Unfortunately, they moved the flagpole.
Oh.
And I complained about that.
Sure. But, oh, goodness.
But yeah,
Scott got tired of the flagpole. All right, Sue, and then back to Warren.
Do you have time for like a 3-minute example, maybe?
Man, I will take all the testimonies. So Sue wants to get in, and then we're going to skip Warren. We'll go to Marilyn and then come back to Warren. So Sue first.
Well, I was just thinking of ways that God works through someone, and I think God worked through Marilyn Johnson to bring our group from Cottage Grove to Covenant. She was the one that grabbed Anne's arm when we came to visit and just worked us right in with the crowd and said, this is where you need to be. And Marilyn, we thank you for that.
We thank you.
So do the rest of us, Marilyn.
Yeah, I was an usher that day, and I had heard about the Cottage Grove ladies. you had a reputation.
Well, God was working for you that day.
That's great. We loved having you.
Thank God for that. Yeah, great. Marilyn, how about yours?
Okay, well, Bob and I had this charismatic experience together. We were... We had sons that were teenagers, and one of them was giving us great challenge. What should we say?
Concern
and challenge. We were up hiking in Colorado, went up to a peak, had lunch, and lo and behold, we didn't see anybody on the trail. We saw someone walking up the trail, had never seen them on the crisscrosses at all, came walking up, had his lunch, sat down, and he was a child psychologist, and he started talking to us. He dealt with families and children who were having communication problems, and Bob and I are just looking at each other wondering, we were in the presence of the spirit. And he was so reassuring and encouraging, and offered that when we returned to Des Moines, he would work with us via phone and make sure that we had the resources we needed. And it was just a wonderful, reassuring moment that there was somebody there. It was someone rescuing us. And then to make sure that we were paying attention. We were maybe 18,000 feet or no, 8,000 feet. A thunderstorm came up and we ended up being right below the thunder cloud, and a bolt of lightning came out of the cloud just to make sure we were paying attention. It was the most unbelievable experience. Okay. And it just expanded our, you get stuck in what should we do, wringing your hands. And this was a whole new encouraging experience, and to explore something that really ended up helping us a great deal.
Very cool.
That was a peak experience.
Very good. It was.
That's right.
That's wonderful, Marilyn. That is, what a nice.
And we all got to go to Colorado then. We went back and Brad went with us, and it was a very positive experience. And to have a healing presence like that come into your life is truly a blessing.
Y'all white Presbyterians are more charismatic than you thought you were.
Marilyn brought a lot of people into the church. She was a volunteer coordinator, and you'd always get a phone call, and you couldn't say no to Marilyn. You were awesome, Marilyn.
Thank you.
You still are.
Spirit.
Yeah.
All right, Warren, we had hopscotched over you, and we're back. Wow.
Unfortunately, Marcy has signed off, but she made a comment, to paraphrase what she said, that there are so many people in this world that how could God really be keeping tabs on her and her needs? Well, as a youngster, I was always impressed that Santa Claus could deliver gifts in one evening to everybody throughout the world. But I so wanted to believe that I accepted it. So in that same logic, if you will, I have no problem accepting the fact that I shouldn't know how many people we have in the world, But God does have the ability to keep track of Marcy and Warren and Nathan and even John Sproul. It's doable. It's doable, and I have no problem accepting that. Now, you know, I don't know that I would expect everyone to feel that, but maybe it's just the wanting that to happen. What shall I, there's a phrase that I'm missing. I do so much want that to be the case that I've willed it to be. Yeah, and I'm so sticking to my guns.
Yeah. So you could, yeah, you could sort of write that off as like wishful thinking, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or you can do, this is what Beck is talking about here. You can allow that to be a practice of noticing when God does do stuff. And so that is exactly what we're talking about here. That shift, you know, there are plenty of, you know, interesting sort of philosophical ways to, you know, argue for or against, you know, does God have, you know, each one of us in the palm of the divine hand, right? And so there, you know, you can answer that philosophical question more than one way. And what Beck is pointing us to is that this is not ultimately a philosophical question. This is an experiential question. Do we experience God as that kind of present and intervening? And so that's another way to say, I think, what you're getting at there, Warren, that if you look for it, it's there. Right. Okay. Pam is raising her hand, but we can't see her. So Pam, go ahead.
Oh, well, actually I have a couple. I have a sister who's an alcoholic, and another sister and I are her legal guardians. And once she was in assisted living, and then she thought she was ready to go out and be in an apartment. Well, it didn't work out. She started drinking again. So before we could get her back into assisted living, we had her at the hospital. We thought, what are we going to do with her before we can put her back in assisted living? So we thought, well, we'll go see her counselor. Well, the counselor wasn't available. And so we're sitting there thinking what to do. And the clerk sitting there says, well, is there something I can do? Do you have a problem? So we told her what was going on, that we weren't quite sure what to know to do with my sister for a few days. And she said, oh, did you know that we have a temporary facility here where people can stay up to a week? We thought, well, that's wonderful. And then she said, we have counseling. And so to my sister Debbie and I, that was a God moment. And then another time, different situation, Debbie and I, the same sister, we travel out together, and we've gone on a riverboat cruise in Europe. And at one point, we wanted to visit another city that wasn't on the agenda. And they said, yeah, you know, you can take the train over there, and then you can get the bus back and meet the boat. So we got to where we wanted to go and had a good time. And so we got on a bus to go back. And so halfway back, the bus driver said, well, I have a break for an hour and a half. We thought, uh-oh, because we didn't want to miss the ship. And so finally, you know, we got going again, and then we got to the town, and one of the people on the ship had explained, you know, how to get where to go. Well, she didn't explain it well enough, because we got back there and the bus driver says, well, this is where I let you out. And it wasn't by the river. So we went walking, and there were, by this time it was midnight, and there were university students out. So we asked them the way to the river. And so we started walking toward the river, and we were gone about 45 minutes. We were really afraid we were going to miss the boat, which was leaving at 1:30 in the morning, and we couldn't find it. And so we're walking along, and there's a guy sitting in a taxi, a young man doing nothing. So we went up to him and said, you know this, you know, riverfront pretty well? He said, yeah. He said, well, do you know about the river boats? Oh, yeah, I know about them. So he says, I think there's one over there. So we went down there. And it was the same company, but the wrong boat. So they said, it's down there. And, you know, they said, it's such and such a location. And the taxi driver said, oh, I know where that is. So he took us down there. We got back on with 2 minutes to spare. But I thought, you know, if that taxi driver hadn't been there, it just, these things come along in life that just at the right moment when you need them. And, you know, to me, that's a God moment. He's looking out for you. That's it.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Pam. So it is that attentiveness to those moments and attentiveness to the ways that God intervenes. And it can be in big, spectacular ways. It can be in little, tiny ways. And the point is not the size of the way that God intervenes. And it's not about, you know, coming up with the right criteria for, you know, that was God intervening, but this one wasn't. It's about that hermeneutics of gratitude, paying attention, interpreting life through that lens of gratitude for God intervening and expecting God to intervene. There's your charismatic enchantment.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.